Are you valuable because of what you've done and learned and been certified on in the past? Or are you valuable because of what you are going to do to make improvements?
Welcome to the Enterprise Intelligence Podcast with CEO Shiny Docs, Jason Cassidy, and VP Customer Success, Davey Sliman. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Doing great.
Yep, very well, yeah. Steve. Thank you.
Yeah.
Davey, why don't you just hop right in?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. Jason, it's funny. You and I in this series have talked a little bit about this before, but we actually were also talking a little bit about it earlier today before we joined. So I think it's incredibly timely. I wanted to bring something I read recently from our friends at Gartner, who had done a study recently and posted some of the results, and I'm sure you can pay to get the full results and that kind of thing. They had done a little bit of a study on organizational change, and in particular around organizational change initiatives that enterprise or level organizations have done. And you know what they were reporting is that the number of these organizational change initiatives that are happening around the world has gone through the roof in the last few years, maybe unsurprisingly, with all of the things that have happened really, even during and since COVID. But the willingness to support those changes has absolutely plummeted. And in fact, they report that only 39% of the organizations that they surveyed have said that the organizational change initiatives have performed well against the stated goals of the projects, right? So the organizations are going through these big initiatives to change how they do things. Sometimes at kind of a macro huge level, sometimes completely readjusting who they have in their business and how they work. And only 39% of those have been reported as being successful against the goals. And the thing that I wanted to talk about is, why are we so bad at this? I don't mean you and me, Jason or Steve, but why are we as people so bad at this? I mean, there's a whole discipline called change management. There are change management projects, there are roles, and people get hired as change managers. And in fact, there's a whole certification called the CCMP. I don't know if you're aware of that, but there's a whole certification out there that's kind of a subset of PMP for people that are involved in change management professionally. It reminds me a little bit of the conversation that we were having this morning, where I think about what we're doing at Shiny Docs with our customers, with Shiny Docs Pro specifically, but even stuff that we've been doing for years with customers, where a lot of what we're doing implies an organizational change. And in many cases, the change that we're introducing is fighting against inaction or fighting against doing nothing. So what we are offering a lot of the time in a lot of our projects is an organizational change to the status quo, to the way things have always been done. And what I wanted to, I'm getting to my actual point, I promise. What I wanted to call out and talk about is something that didn't get pulled out of the Gartner stuff, but that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which is that we have our greatest successes with our customers when people are fully involved. And when we, as a software vendor, come in with empathy and we come in with a practical approach to changing the way an organization does something. And it reminds me of that kind of classic proverb, which is, if you tell me something, I'm going to forget about it. If you show me something, I might remember it. But if you involve me in it, I will understand it and be engaged in it. And so, I wanted to riff on this topic, kind of writ large, but maybe more specifically about, what we know best, which is, kind of large scale information management projects that lead to organizational change. And to what extent, Jason, you feel, or even Steve, you know, what to what extent you feel the key piece of it is the human. You know, we're a tech company, we're a software company, and it's easy for us to get up and say, we've got all these buttons and features that you're going to love. But when I think about the greatest successes that we have with our customers and the greatest successes that these projects have, it's when we are hyper engaged and involved with the human beings associated with the change.
There's a lot there, and it's good. It is a, I'm glad that before the show you introduced it as a comprehensive topic. So what I'm going to try to do is hit to the heart of the why, and then maybe we can work it backwards, because there's all sorts of different facets that we can touch on, but none of it matters unless you look at why. And the why of change is two things. Everybody knows this. There's fear and greed. There is the idea, and let's just not use greed in its most extreme example, and let's not use fear in its most extreme example. Let's look at the day-to-day mundane fear and greed. So on the greed side, I need to accumulate enough wealth to pay for the thing that I want to pay for right now. So the thing that I might want to pay for right now is to make sure that my kids, you know, I can pay for their college or university. I want to make sure that I can make my mortgage payment, normal things. So there's a greed aspect. I need to accumulate some type of wealth so that I can do something. So how are you going to help me do that? And then separately, fear is the idea of starting with, I don't want to die. So how emergent is the scariness of what you're talking about? So I don't think cancer is going to kill me tomorrow. My body feels relatively good. I don't have any specific examples of how it might happen. So all of a sudden the fear of cancer is just kind of gone. So people will tend to smoke. They will tend to drink. They'll tend to stay up too late. They'll tend to do all the things that kind of feel good in the moment, yet put themselves in jeopardy for heart disease and cancer and the thing that will eventually kill them, because they're not feeling the fear right now. So if we look at those two goalposts and say that everything that we do that motivates us falls somewhere in that spectrum, now all of a sudden look at the risk of a cybersecurity incident, the risk of embarrassment because of privacy, or the risk to the business that people can't find what they need to do their job. And the idea of, if people found what they need to do their job, would we actually make an extra dollar? Would I get rich more? Would I accumulate wealth faster? And because those things aren't specifically right in your face, there's not an enemy right at the gate banging on your door like cancer, or literally another enemy, another person trying to kill you. What's the motivator for these things that we all agree? They're kind of like going to the gym. We agree that it's the right thing to do. Yeah. So why do people not always do it?
Why do they live with the status quo?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you surprised to hear the Gartner number of, you know, 39% of these things, only 39% come close to achieving the goals that were, you know, planned?
Of course, because it's New Year's, these goals are New Year's resolutions. Like, unless you truly have something that's highly motivating you, like when you think of the greatest achievement of mankind might be putting humans' feet on the moon.
Sure.
It's pretty cool. And it took 400,000 people. It took a huge amount of engineering and innovation and these types of things for a goal that ended up yielding all sorts of technology and fantastic outcomes. It was motivated by fear. Mm-hmm. It's the fear of some people who we used to talk to and we fought a war alongside them. All of a sudden, they literally put up this thing called the Iron Curtain, and we don't talk to them anymore. And they plan on taking over the world. Right. Maybe. I don't know. So it's just, I'm afraid of these people. Therefore, what am I going to do? Not only am I going to make rockets so intimidating that I might be able to blow them up, I'm going to make rockets so intimidating that I can take over the solar system, was the intent. And once it happened, then all of a sudden the motivation was gone. So like, that was a pretty cool motivation. So what we're left with in the absence of something so aggressive, because you and I, maybe Steve, you missed this one, but when I was young, we still did bomb drills. Yep. What do you do when the nuclear bomb drops? You knew how to get under your desk or whatever, these types of things. Yeah, underneath a table is where they wanted you to be.
When, totally safe. That'll stop.
We'll be fine.
We'll stop enriched uranium from
tables. Were sturdier back then than they are today. Yeah. So I mean, that's probably less of a good idea. But anyway, short story long is we're highly motivated at the time to do some things, whereas now it's kind of this weird nebulous trolley problem, where I know for sure that if I don't do something, then I'm definitely going to kill myself and others at some point in the future. You know, like it's with my business. We're all going to go down the tube because competitively we're going to lose if we don't have a successful innovation project over the next few years. But if I decide to make a change, I change the tracks myself, and then we go somewhere and it's not successful, then I'm going to get shot. Okay. I'm the one person on the tracks if I make the turn, whereas it's other people on the tracks if we leave the trolley going where it is. So it is a weird motivator. It's like, well, if I don't do anything and I'm not going to get fired, therefore, for sure, in the future, somebody's going to get screwed. But it's not going to be me. Whereas if I make the change and it doesn't work, then I'm the one that gets hit by the trolley.
So is that too much fear or not enough fear? Like, or is it a lack of leadership? What are the reasons why we can't, again, I'm not talking about the three of us, but we as people, as society, why can we not make the big important changes? Is it not enough fear, not enough greed? If it's one of those two things, because to your point, like every organization that is looking at itself, that looks inwardly and says, geez, we're not very productive. We're not very efficient. Our competitors are, nipping at our heels here. We really need to change something really quick. You know, we know that we need to change something, and yet team members will resist it at every turn. There'll be parts of the organization that'll say, no, too expensive, too risky, too slow. We're not going to do that. We're going to skip this stuff. You know, despite all the evidence to the contrary, people will continue to make bad choices about the thing that they absolutely need to make a better choice about. I don't know.
Yeah, and this is what I mean. It's just, if we take it from the simple thing of fear and greed, it is, and again, basic versions of them, not necessarily nuclear bombs dropping or not necessarily I'm going to become a billionaire, but somewhere, you know, set the goalposts a little bit more realistic for the day to day. The issue that we run into constantly is that the reward for making change is often like it's just the default. It should be making change is obvious. Right. We need to make a change because we see ourselves, the trolley going towards five people instead of one, and it's going to kill us all. It's going to kill them. So the idea of making the change should be the default position. However, when you look at what's the biggest predictor of wealth in the world, whether or not you are wealthy. What's the number one predictor?
Your family's wealth.
Whether or not your parents are wealthy. Right. So do wealthy families have the best ideas?
No, of course not.
Well, then what's in the best interest of the wealthy families?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, making sure it stays that way.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that to me is the obvious number one issue, is that companies that are already making money, good enough, don't want to change. Families who are already wealthy and now making money based upon wealth instead of labor want to maintain that. So where is the, if that controls, if that zeitgeist, that environment controls how much of the wealth, I'm going to say controls 90% of the wealth, then innovation is way over in this 10% or less of wealth is dedicated to innovation.
It's a rounding error.
It's a total rounding error. So everything about the 90% fights change in innovation the whole way. And then the second that an innovation survives all of that negativity, then all of a sudden the 90% jumps on top of it and invests in it and says it was ours all along. So it's just, this is the reality of what the universe that we live in, and whether it's good or bad or whatever, nothing's inherently good or bad. It's either beneficial, benign, or negative. These are the forces that keep us from making continuous innovation just the norm.
Yeah, because, you know, every time I've read anything about change management or change managers or, you know, this change management certification, part of me, like, you guys know me well enough to know that I absolutely go crazy when things don't change. Like, I really struggle through, if I look back through my illustrious, I say with a giggle, through my illustrious career and think about times when I've had roles at companies or organizations where things never changed, I would go nuts. I couldn't stand situations that I found myself in where there was no willingness to change and explore a new way of doing things. It, you know, it was like, well, no, well, this is how we do things. It's great. It's awesome. You just do your, there's like a bunch of pellets that come down at the start of every day on a treadmill and you do your little things. And then at the end of the day, you turn off your computer and then you go home. I hated those situations personally. So the thing that I've always struggled with, and maybe this is just, again, me personally, is how can every organization not be constantly exploring change to improve and innovate the way they do things? And maybe, you know, what your take on it is that there are lots of companies that are super happy just saying, "Ah, oh, we're actually already making money hand over fist and things are pretty good. And why would I stick my neck out? Why would I try something different when we're, you know, still making lots of money doing the things that we've always done?"
Yep. So if I wanted to change one thing about humanity, I would change this one thing. Let's call it Cassidy's Law or something like that. It would be, are you valuable because of what you've done and learned and been certified on in the past? Or are you valuable because of what you are going to do to make improvements?
Yeah.
So I'm going to suggest that the majority of people want to be valued for what they think that they are. Well, I have a university degree. Well, I'm the one who did this change management project, therefore laud me. I'm the one who achieved this particular status. I am the minister. I am the senator. I'm the whatever. I am a thing now. And I should be rewarded for being this thing.
Not the thing that you're growing into.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, what's funny is, and this is the beauty of being neurodivergent, like I mild autism, major ADHD for myself, it makes it easy to look at these things going, well, that's just boring as shit. I get no dopamine from the idea of what, something I've done before. Yeah. And this is just personally, like I'm won hockey championships and finished races and these types of things, and that I don't care about the medal or the reward or bragging about this or that. There's no milestone. What do you mean milestone? Getting to the finish line? Of course you're going to get to the finish line because you did the damn work. So it's the work that matters. It's how much fun you can have while you're actually making a change, taking a risk. And that is unusual. In fact, you have to be neurodivergent in order to get enjoyment out of, you know, it's the massive risk of failure. And it's just not the default position. So how many humans are there out there that get enjoyment, get dopamine from the default position of taking the risk?
Not that many, probably.
Maybe not. So it's just, yeah. So when we take it back to your original, the hypothesis, thought, questions, is like, it's why do only 39% of these things succeed? It's because the entire universe is designed to maintain some, it's designed to degrade. It's entropy. It's designed to get worse. And it takes a lot of work, literal energy, to improve things. And not a lot of people have that energy or that by default. So I'm not saying people are bad, quite frankly. I'm saying I'm the one that's the idiot. I'm the one who's different. Okay. It's like, why am I constantly trying to make things better? Why would you do that? That's dumb. But we like to pretend. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like how many leaders have you seen who voted against something hated it the whole way. And then once it was successful, latched on.
Oh, yeah. They're just this is my idea all along, or, yeah. Or I always knew this would work, or Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's, we don't have to stick on this forever, but my wheels are really turning here. Like, do you think that there's also a little bit of devil, you know, with people where they can look at a system or a process that clearly is kind of okay, like, you know, storing terabytes and terabytes of data on an S drive. I got an S drive. It's completely, it's got a petabyte of data on it. We just keep adding disk to it. Keep adding disk. We can do that forever. Disk is cheap. Da, 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 da. I know that nobody can find it. I know there's a bunch of stuff in there that's duplicated. I know that da, 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 but we can just keep doing that forever. Do you think that a little bit of it is, when I say the kind of like the devil, you know, is if we change something or do something new or innovative, there's a chance it might be worse. We might do a new thing and spend a lot of time and energy, to your point about, you know, energy expenditure. We're going to spend a lot of time and energy on this new thing, and the new thing might not be as good as this thing that we've got now that we know isn't that good.
Yeah.
Is that the fear? Is that the fear part?
I don't think that exists. Yeah. Because what you're talking about is a level of creativity that people could imagine alternate futures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So think about what's the reality for most people is most people come to a fork in the road and they choose a path based upon what they know or what they could research in this instant. I know that this city's down this path and this town's down that path. Right. So let me research everything I know about this or that. And then they make a choice based upon historical evidence. And so the choice is not, there's no, you notice that the choice isn't, I'm going to plow my way through the forest and make my own path.
No.
When you come to a fork in the road, why isn't it a default to go, what do you mean a fork in the road? There's infinite paths from there. You could go straight up, build a rocket and go straight up. Right. Why don't we even consider that as part of the metaphor? Mm-hmm. It's because it's not the default behavior. The default behavior is asking, is this going to be on the test? Do I have to know this? And when it comes to that S drive that's growing leaps and bounds, it's a fork in the road. And is the fork in the road saying, we are going to do continuous file analysis and continuous reduction of information so that we can optimize this storage and make people better by finding it continuously? That sounds like an awesome thing. But people don't, that's not on the menu. No. What's on the menu is, do I move it to SharePoint? Or do I refresh my hardware? And it's like, why is that the fork? Why are those the only two options?
Yeah. I mean, I love that you went in that direction. Cause I mean, it touches on something that we've been saying all along, which is that, you know, an S drive on a network, on its own is actually not a problem. It's a great technology. It's been around forever. Super reliable. Yeah. You could create an S. Your users, this is the funny thing, your users love the S drive. It's like, well, I got a file and when I'm working on it, I put it in the S drive because S stands for share, and everybody just goes and looks for the file in there. The problem that I have is I can't find the things that I was looking for, and I'm worried that, you know, I'm not maybe not working on the latest version of it, and there's a lot of junk in there, right? So, you know, to your point, the path that's laid out for people, the fork in the road, is false, or it's just not necessarily the fork that people have to take. There's another version of the whole thing which says keep your S drive, keep your network shares if you absolutely want to, if you're fine with them and that kind of thing, but you can do something completely different with it. You can overlay a search, you can reduce your duplicates, you can get rid of your obsolete and trivial stuff. You can also tag all that data to make it way easier to find and categorize and put like documents together and keep disparate documents apart. Wow. Covered a lot of
ground here. For sure. Well, and that's the trick. So if we take it back to the original hypothesis, why did only 39% of projects succeed? It's because you didn't do that step of, people go, oh, well, we got to do this. And the zeitgeist says that you got to take this path in the road. And quite frankly, the paths that are set for you generally are not the innovation paths. They're what everybody's done before paths, and only 30% of those projects work. So why would you be different?
Yeah. Why are you going to be
literally
special?
You're saying that 30% of the well-known paths work. Mm-hmm. And people keep choosing the well, they don't ask, okay, what should be done? They say, who's done this before? Okay. And then they pick a path that has a 39% efficacy.
Somebody comes in, well, 39% of the people have done this thing and it worked. Oh, sounds good. Sign me up.
Nobody sounds would like. Yeah. I want to get on that airline where it's just, yeah, it's you have out of every 10 flights, you almost get four that actually land.
Yeah. And to tie it back to the conversation that we had had earlier today too, we know that a whole bunch of folks never even get to that point. And they just say, we're not even going to try. We're just going to keep doing the thing that we always did, because doing nothing is easier. And we know that not exercising and not eating properly and drinking too much alcohol and smoking cigarettes, we know that eventually that's going to get us. We totally know that this is going to get us. But if I choose to do nothing, that's super safe for me personally. That's super safe for my team right now, today.
And back to the trolley problem. Yeah. And if listeners don't know the trolley problem, just Google it, check it out. It's a pretty simple metaphor. And so the people that are on the tracks that are getting run over are the ones who say, I can't find things on the S drive. I was just hired here a week ago and I have no idea where it is. I got to ask Steve where everything is, or we got to have Teams calls, or we end up recreating half of our data. So literally, instead of five people on being on the tracks, how many people are in your organization? 10,000? Well, there's 10,000 people on that track. So they're constantly getting run over because I think that my only job is to decide to either do nothing or move the data to some other system. Right. And those aren't the choices. Okay. There's 100 things you can do to improve those people. It's you got to change lanes a little bit. It's just a little shift. Yep. And I get it. You put yourself on the tracks from that little shift, but it's better than just, barreling down the same road that you're on right now, knowing that 10,000 people are not going to be able to find what they need on the S drive. So they end up having more Teams calls, more collaboration, recreating data, not finding stuff, more turnover. People hate the job because they can't do their job, and all that expense is due to a lack of an innovative mindset as to how can I improve their lives just a wee bit today
by making in some cases modest changes. Like, that's the thing that kind of kills me about the whole thing, especially when you bring it into the context of ShineDocs. Some of the stuff that we do with our customers is pretty straightforward, pretty quick, really quick projects, really quick outcomes, measured in days and weeks rather than months or years. And you do these incredible things in such a short period of time that make people's lives so much better in their work, in terms of being able to find what they're looking for, in being able to feel good that they've got the content that they need to do their jobs. Like, I don't know, wouldn't you want that for all of your users? And if you could do it really quickly, I would.
Sure. And I mean, and that's, you got to write the, ask the right person, because unfortunately some of the people that are tasked with this aren't tasked with making anybody's life better. Right. They're literally tasked with the hardware refresh is coming up and we don't want to do it. So what are the alternatives? Yeah. So they pick a false, like the question itself is poorly framed. Right.
Yeah.
So they're not actually asking who needs this information and why, and what can we do to make it more available to them. That would be a better question than the hardware refresh is coming up and what are our alternatives.
Or I've been told, I feel like we pick on SharePoint too much. It's not fair to SharePoint.
SharePoint's great.
But I've been told that we're moving to SharePoint, so that's my task. And my task is not to ask whether that's the right decision or not. My task is just to move this stuff from file shares up to a SharePoint.
Yeah. And it's there's no such thing as bad products or bad technology or whatever. If it works, it works. SharePoint has a ton of partners out there. It's got a ton of capabilities and features and functionality, and every one of them work. It's great. The part that's bad is the vendor who lies to you, who says, this is the choice that you need to make. Look, it's the choice that everybody else made. Therefore, it's the choice that you must make. Mm-hmm. Not reminding them that six out of the or 6.1 out of the 10 people who follow that path are dissatisfied with what they did. Mm-hmm. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just how many smartphone users are dissatisfied with owning a smartphone?
Yeah. Probably
out of 10, zero. Yeah. Zero, because it's they're amazing packaging. Mm-hmm. They've evolved to something that is just power beyond its cost. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. What about data management? It's which one of those has achieved smartphone level satisfaction? Zero out of 10. Mm-hmm. Okay. And none of them are bad. I'm just, the problem is, back to the original thing, is like, if you ask the wrong question, you take either fork in the road that's well established, that is guaranteed to have no satisfaction, mm-hmm. then you're going to keep getting the same outcomes over and over again. Maybe you'll improve a wee bit. Good for you. Success, what is even 3.9 out of 10? Who measures that success? Right,
these are against goals established by the organization associated with whatever the change management project is, right? So
let's take it back to fear and greed and say, let's measure it against, are we actually making substantially more wealth because of this change? Sure. Smartphones, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. I do not have to go to the bank anymore to do all my financial transactions. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. I do not have to, kill a tree to get my news every morning. Like, that's pretty cool. Like, there's a million amazing mm-hmm. outcomes that have 1,000x returns that we get from certain technologies that are packaged well, that are high efficiency, that scale. This is back to our design thinking. Idea. Yeah. When you think about the best products, they have this amazing yield. And when you think about the worst products, and unfortunately, when we get into data management, it's not that they're bad products themselves. They're oversold as solutions to a problem when, quite frankly, they're just not. And yeah, 6 out of 10 information professionals will agree that we failed with that project.
We did this thing that either didn't need to be done at all, or there were false equivalencies created around the value that we thought we were going to get from this thing. Yeah. This is one of the things that I think about all the time, and I think about it so much in the context of how can I understand people better so that these ideas can be communicated better. And I think it's going to be a lifelong journey for me personally, because it's the part, you notice, like, almost nothing that I raised in the start of this was about the tech. And it really, to your point, like, I really feel that very little of this is actually about the tech. I feel this is entirely about and I love the way you went to kind of the human part of it about fear, about greed, because I think that at the core of it, this is the problem. It's not that we haven't designed a cool app the best new app. I don't think that's it at all. I think it's that the human part of it is missing or, absent.
Yeah. And that's okay. It's just that's okay. We just need to remind ourselves that we're the weird ones. We are the unusual ones. Not weird in a bad way. Just it is uncommon to be really comfortable with making change. And it's uncommon to, show people that there's a different fork in the road that they didn't even know existed. Because it's that's just not the way people buy or behave or whatever. Yeah. And I get it. And that's okay. So it's our job to beat down that path.
Yeah.
And then invite people along, say, hey, look, come along. You can come this way.
Yeah.
You can come along this way right now. I've chopped down every little branch that's gotten in our way. It's now a path, and it's just an obvious thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. And when we get there with promoting file analysis, with promoting understanding the data, making it available to your users, giving them an amazing search, once they understand that this is actually the beat down path that is way better than focusing on just the hardware refresh or trying to move data somewhere, then the next thing will come along to try to replace us. Yeah. There'll be some other innovator going, well, you guys are missing it. Right. I got this AI, what's it, that's going to just do all that anyway.
Love it. Yeah. Good chat on that one.
Yeah, for sure. So, and that's a good segue into the the AI what's it.
The AI what's it. I love it.
Yeah, because it's I'm going to suggest that there's this thing out there that we talk about called this is the general artificial intelligence, or AGI, mm-hmm. and artificial general intelligence, the thing that we have, mm-hmm. a general knowledge based upon a repository of information and experiences and some intuition that is also based upon what you genetically have an experience that allows you to pattern match very so organically that you don't even realize that you're doing it. And we jumped the gun a little bit, and now it's jumped the shark on generative AI,
right?
Where generative AI is a speech writer who has no idea what the topic is that we're talking about, but they've heard other people talk about it before. So they're going to write a new speech that uses kind of similar words. Right. So, my question is, did people think that generative AI was going to be AGI?
Popularly? Yeah. I think so. I think if you're talking about, kind of person on the street interview, if you're going to pick, 40 people off the street and ask them, I think that absolutely that's where people thought it was going, even if they didn't have the words for it or the jargon. Right. I think one of the things, especially when you're talking about Gen AI and what it's now become popularly understood, is for me weirdly connected to what people have always wanted or hoped computing to be. Even when I look back to when I was a little boy and I thought about, computing, and, computers were coming into the classroom and we had a computer. We were one of the first people on the street that had a computer at home, and like a home computer that my dad brought home one day, and, pet Commodore kind of thing. And, when people think about computing, they think about, how can I offload thinking from me? How can I offload work from me? And, and of course, for decades now, even going back even earlier into the 50s and 50s sci-fi and things like that, the assumption has been that with artificial intelligence and robots and computing in general, that the hard part of being a person gets taken away, and all that's left is the easy stuff, loving your kids and having dinner and, riding your bicycle and all these other things. And the hard stuff, like long division and doing your taxes, is going to be done by robots or AI. And in a weird way, I think that's what people want. I think people really want the Gen AI that we know today, which is somebody doing work for me, or a computer doing work for me for this thing, because I don't want to write this article, or I don't want to create this image, or I don't want to write this song, doing the work for you.
So I think I agree with all that, and I'm going to attack that. Not you.
No,
I'm going to attack that thinking, is because it misses the point or the goal. The point or the goal, back to your initial conversation, should be what can I do that's higher, faster, stronger? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Everything that you said, and I like the way that you said it because it allowed me to make this point a little bit stronger, is it's just, you're trying to achieve the same baseline with less effort.
Yeah.
Okay. So the baseline of, I can maximize my leisure time. I can go for a better bike ride because I have less work to do. And I got I did my long division, and now my spreadsheet is done. Yay. Check. And there's nothing in there about how do I actually ship more widgets? How do I make somebody else better in that? And I feel like that's kind of the interesting thing, is that if that's the goal, is how can I just make my day a little smoother without necessarily improving anybody else? I'm just, my work is easier. Nothing has improved.
No.
Is that true?
Yeah. Like 100%. Like it is tied to the stuff we were talking about earlier. It's like, if I'm just going to get robots or computers to do the status quo so that I don't have to do the status quo. I can do other things. You know what I mean? Like, you're essentially saying, like, I've got this terrible system and this terrible process that's not efficient, but man, it takes me 12 hours a day. And now I'm going to get a robot to do this terrible system and this terrible process. And it can do it can do all the work that I don't want to do, but it's not advancing anything. It's not improving anything.
Because there should be an implication that now you have 12 hours free to do something even better.
Right. But I don't think people are thinking that way. I don't think. Maybe that's cynical. Well,
that was our entire first 40 minutes of this conversation. Yeah. Of course they're not.
Yeah.
So
they're not improving themselves with all this extra time.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, good. So, now I can sit on the couch and turn off my brain while my robot does this work, does this long division.
I like it. So when you take it to the why, it's the whole idea is everybody wants to be the inherited wealth thing. Okay. Right. What's the problem with inherited wealth is that the inherited wealth allows you to make money without providing really any value to society.
Right.
You know, just because you own the buildings that somebody rents, is that valuable to society? No, do you feel like you're great people? No, of course not. It's not garbage. I mean, it's not bad per se, but it's not innovative. It's not progressing society. Nobody's going to live longer or better because of this.
Mm-hmm.
But we remind ourselves that's not the goal of anybody. The goal is the status quo. Mm-hmm. So it's a reminder that even people who don't have inherited wealth, their goal is the status quo too. How do I get more leisure time without doing more work or whatever? Give me that generative AI. So anyway, that's not exactly where I was intending to go with this, but I like the destination where we went here, is that this idea of, we thought that AI was going to do something for us, because I read everything from cure cancer to a million other things. And now it's a script writer who saves us a couple hours in the day, but we don't know what to do with that hour to actually improve something.
Mm-hmm.
Back to our original conversation.
Or worse, you become the custodian of a machine that writes scripts, right? So just like in the old days, when factories, automation first came into factories, whether you go back to Henry Ford or not, you go back to some kind of assembly line, you're making cars a lot faster. Obviously cars move down a conveyor belt and each person does their thing, but there's also a person who knows how the whole machine works, and their job is to make sure that the machine keeps doing the thing. And so now what you've done, especially on the generative AI side, is you've created a whole class of people whose job it is to know how the generative AI machine works. And like, so that you can write faster, marketing copy, I guess. I don't know.
I think, Davey, there's an interesting point there also, where you look at using sort of generative AI as an attempt to make your life and job easier. But on the other side, there's, a lot of programs and a lot of software that's being trained to identify generative AI. And I know, having recently taken on doing social media management, that like LinkedIn, for example, is capable of like identifying posts that have been generated by AI and will like delist those posts. So you think you're saving time. Well, AI is going to write my social posts, but then it's LinkedIn is like, hey, those are AI posts, and doesn't like get them out there. So you've not really saved any time at all.
Yeah. And this is, this is also tied to the part that bothers me. And I'm glad you called out, Jason, you said curing cancer, for example, or, solving medical challenges. To me, again, differentiating, generative AI from the AI that that I always thought about before generative AI became such a trendy thing, which is, we're going to get to the point where an artificial intelligence can be used to scale thinking to a level that an individual human can't achieve. And so the example then would be like, setting an AI against a giant mathematical problem or a giant scientific problem, which, no offense intended to humanity, an individual human is just not going to be able to scale their brain to do those many that many calculations in that amount of time to arrive at a molecule or an enzyme that would be useful for combating cancer, you know, because you know, that to me is where this that to me is an innovation. That is where this should be going, and it is going. We see all kinds of evidence to suggest that, you know, pharma agencies are using these types of technologies and massive computing capabilities to do these massive number crunching exercises that teams of very, very smart mathematicians still couldn't do, you know, as quickly or as efficiently. So for the scientists and mathematicians that need that information and they need it quickly, AI represents this incredible ability to do the next innovation faster. Yeah.
So, and I feel like this is something that it's with a few minutes left, we can't explore it deep enough, but I think perhaps we even need to have a talk about innovation itself. So when you mentioned Ford with the car, there was lots of cars on the quote unquote road back when Ford invented his Model T, but his Model T, the innovation wasn't the fact that it's a motorized automobile. There was tons of them out there, Buicks and everything else at the time. The innovation was it was affordable because he had a cheap manufacturing process. Yeah. He could roll one out within an hour, whereas a Buick at the time took 14 hours to build, hand assemble, and it cost literally five times as much. So that was the innovation, was making something. And what was the goal? The actual innovation wasn't the car itself. It was the fact that you could have friends in a neighboring city 30 miles away that you could go visit on the weekends. Because prior to the motorized vehicle accessible to everybody, you were at stagecoach speed or horse speed. And whether somebody lived 30 miles away or 3,000 miles away, it didn't matter. They were inaccessible to you. Okay. Now they're accessible to you. You can make plans with them. You can go see them on a whim.
Okay.
I can go drive there in less than an hour, go visit, and then drive back.
Driving became so a leisure activity.
Right? Yeah. Going this up for is a the drive. Innovation itself. So, and I think that gets lost in why I say it's worthy of it's an entire, because we throw this word innovation around, but you can't just say it substitutes labor. That's just substituting labor is not innovation. What matters is, can you do something now that you could never do before? Could you go to a neighboring city? Like if I talk about what I call the ultimate innovation was getting to the moon. We're doing even better than that now-ish. We're not putting people much further than that, but that's the whole idea is, do we have capabilities way beyond what we have right now? Or are we just making what we do right now a little easier? One is the kind of innovation that transforms humanity, and the other one is the kind of innovation that, you know, generates some profit.
Right.
So there's a big difference, and I think we need to recognize that one has higher value to society than the other.
I think we're telegraphing our next session absolutely should be the innovation episode. And I'm excited to talk about that because it's all tied to what we're talking about here. It's one of my favorite things, you know, to talk about. Right. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Foreshadowing.
We haven't really, because the whole, for people that aren't aware, the whole thing that we've been doing with this whole podcast all along is that you and I have been sort of bringing surprise topics to each other. And one of the things that I've been amazed by episode after episode is how we've been able to find the connections between these. Maybe not unsurprisingly, you and I think about a lot of the same stuff a lot of the time. But maybe if we do a purposeful episode about innovation, I think we can really sink our teeth into the topic. So particularly here in the Canadian context, of course, because it's a huge topic of conversation in this country.
What do you think, Steve?
I love it. I'm going to put a note to make sure that next episode 12 will be the innovation episode.
All right. Cool.
Well, thanks, guys. That was a good conversation this week. We'll pick it up again with the innovation episode.
I love it. We're going to need special innovation episode music, I think, if you could find something really innovative. Maybe some strange titles. Futuristic jazz or something. Totally innovative.
Love it. Awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Enterprise Intelligence is a Shiny Docs podcast with Jason Cassidy and Davey Sliman, produced by Stephen Schuntz. Copyright 2024. If you would like to learn more about how Shiny Docs can make it easy to organize your content, protect your data, and make your users happy, visit shinydocs.com today.